So today, our speaker is Dr. Janine Teese. She has more than 25 years of professional experience in criminal justice. She holds a PhD in political science with an emphasis on criminal control policy analysis, as well as a MA in psychology. Dr. Teese has taught criminal justice and political science at Lindenwood University since 2007 and is currently chair of the Masters of Public Administration program and coordinates the Hammond Institute Criminal Justice Reform Initiative. She was a prison psychologist for 9 years and directed Missouri State Sex Offender Program. Her areas of expertise include program and policy development and evaluation, offender risk assessment, criminal thinking errors, and treatment of sex offenders and antisocial offenders.
So, as Eric said, my background is criminal justice. I started my career as a prison psychologist. When I was 12 years old, I read In Cold Blood and decided I wanted to be a prison psychologist. And eventually went on to do that. I left the prison system, and I worked there from 1985 to 1994. I left in 1994 and started doing consulting around the research for offender reentry, offender treatment program, also with courts and juvenile justice. And I say that because it seems like it's been a long time since I worked in prisons, in 1994. And when I've taught corrections, some of my students have asked me, haven't things changed a lot since you've left? Surprisingly, and sadly, they haven't changed a great deal. I have stayed in touch with, when I taught corrections classes, I routinely took my students on tours, so about 4 or 6 times a year I would be in the prisons. I'm close friends with the warden of the Missouri Eastern Correctional Center, and I stay in touch with practices that are happening in the system. And I work with Missouri probation, federal probation, and some local service providers around offender reentry. So my knowledge is more current than it may seem based on having worked in prisons a couple decades ago now. Thanks for the song. I couldn't have chosen a better one had I been asked. I have the album up on the wall in my office. Just some baseline. How many of you work in criminal justice or have perhaps studied criminal justice extensively in school? Like Rachel has, of course. Anybody else has some? What do you do?
I'm a firefighter. Before that, I thought about being a police officer.
Okay, so you get a lot of overlap with that. Okay. I'm talking not directly about prison reform because I think that's a bigger topic than a 45-minute talk, but I think in the interest of people understanding what's needed in prison reform, they need some education around what really happens within our prison system. And there's a lot of myths and misconceptions fueled in part by political talk, fueled in part by pop culture. And I think just some people's understanding about who's an expert, who they should ask about corrections. Most people know people in law enforcement, they know lawyers, but not so often do people know people who actually work on the inside. So I always want to share with people what it's really like. So, just going. Okay. Just some figures. You might often hear 2 million people are, and so you're wondering why is my figure less. That 2 million generally includes the jails. So jails are people who are pretrial. They are awaiting sentencing for their crime, or they are serving a very short sentence and they're not sending them to prison because of overcrowding and because of the delays that result if we're going to ship somebody off to prison after their sentence for just 1 or 2 years. For the most part, nobody's going to do more than 1 year in jail. So you may see 2 million people incarcerated. That includes the jails. Our state and federal system, these are 2016 figures. These are the last figures that are fully calculated and available. And it's not going to be that different today if we were to look at the ones from most recent year when those were merged. Only about 6 to 7% are female. Females tend to be very overlooked. They tend to get a lot of the kind of leftovers of the male system, or they get policy that has been developed based on males' needs. And there's a lot of need for more research into females' unique needs and how to work with them. And we did see a decrease starting in 2015. So although the female population grew a bit, overall, our incarceration population fell in recent years. But here's what was happening before that. Crime peaked in the late 1980s, kind of went down, and then there was a little blip where it peaked again in the early 1990s as a result of the crack cocaine epidemic. Since then, crime has fallen and then kind of fallen and remained steady to a point. We didn't start slowing down on incarcerating people until just a few years ago. So crime is going down, and the incarceration rate is continuing to climb. You know, these trends should track one another, and they haven't. And some people say, well, maybe that's why it was falling. We're incarcerating more people. So some social scientists have kind of deconstructed that data. What they found is the states that started slowing down the incarceration rate, they started sending people away for longer, shorter sentences. They started doing more around keeping people on probation and trying to contain them in the community. Those states that started to see a decline in their prison rates earlier also saw a decline in the crime rates. So we can't say that, well, the incarceration has been working. Actually, it's the opposite. When we incarcerate fewer people and try more things, we've been more successful. What are they in for? About over half the state prisoners are serving time for violent crimes. Something like 3,000 to 5,000, depending on how the researchers count, people are serving life without parole for nonviolent crimes. So life without parole means you're never getting out. You can get out on life sentences, but 49 states now have life without parole. Missouri's one. Some of those people are not in for violent crime. Now, there's a little more to that. They're often in because of something like a mandatory sentencing with a three strikes you're out or the equivalent. They have a series of crimes, and their most recent one wasn't violent. But some of these are for drug possession and things that criminologists believe could better be served by sentences in the community. Federal prisons have 50% are in for drug crimes, and about just like 10% of them are in for violent crimes. Most crime happens at the state level. Federal violent crimes are going to be crimes that happen typically on federal jurisdiction. So they happen in District of Columbia, they happen on a Native American reservation, military compound, things like that. Federal prisons tend to have far more people in for offenses involving perhaps possession of weapon, but not necessarily use of it, and a lot of drug offenders. And this just kind of breaks down. I know this is a really kind of busy graph, and it's just hard to absorb. Remember I mentioned the jails there. Over 500,000 people in the local jails at the point this was done. I put a handout over there if people are interested in knowing a little more and seeing my sources. And this Prison Policy Initiative is a really useful resource, and they're very proactive in trying to communicate about what we need to do better in our prison system. So you can see most of what's happening is in state prisons and the kind of breakdown here of our violent and then property, drug, and the kind of public order offenses could be driving under the influence, weapons possession. And then again, we see here on the, some of these people are detained. They're detained by federal marshals pending some sort of action. The rest are post-conviction. Why should we care about what happens prison side? This is something I would hear a lot from my students. I would hear a lot in other community groups. They said they did something bad. Why do we need to worry about it? Well, if nothing else, I mean, you're the ethical society, and I think you might just care because that's the kind of humanistic philosophy. But the other thing I tell people is for practical reasons. 95% of them are coming back to society at some point, okay? The people who aren't are those lifers without parole, people who die in prison, and people who are on death row facing capital punishment sentences. So the vast majority of them are coming back. And if nothing else, we should care for that reason. We should want prisons to do things right so they come back to us in a way that we have a safer society and they can live harmoniously among us and live productive lives. Missouri stats have always been a little higher for whatever reason. They've always been 97% coming back. So if there's no other reason, that should be it. What is it, you know, it gets to, when we start talking about what should corrections do, we have to say, well, what is it supposed to do? And these are the core purposes. Deter. A lot of people say that that's what it's for. It's we punish people, like we give our kids a time out, we get a fine for something we shouldn't have done. It's to deter both at the individual level, so the person who faces that punishment, we would hope you're not going to do this again because you suffered an unpleasant consequence, and at the general level, that the rest of society sees if we make that mistake, if we commit this act intentionally, not a mistake, we're going to face a punishment, and that would generally deter. General deterrence is a little hard to measure, but most of the research shows that individual deterrence doesn't work in the way that people think it would, which is if we punish really, really harshly, then they're not going to do it again. If we send them away for a long time, if our prisons are particularly austere in terms of privileges and very, very harsh, they won't come back. Most of the research does is a guy named Daniel Nagin, N-A-G-I-N. And if you don't believe that or don't want, you know, want to quote that to somebody, you can look at, he's compiled a lot of the research over the years. So while it seems to make sense when we're raising our children, and maybe it makes sense for many people in society, it doesn't really have any the intended effect in terms of make it tougher and then stop doing it. Rehabilitation has kind of gone through waves in terms of public support and how much we do of it. We're in a little bit of a kind of riding a crest of a little bit of a climate for more support right now. We're seeing more dialogue across the aisle in state legislatures for let's try to do something that works versus the rhetoric that we still hear and we heard for so long in the 80s and 90s, which was lock them up, get tough. We're in a little bit of phase where maybe we're seeing some recognition that wasn't working. So rehabilitation means many things. It could mean psychological treatment, like I did in my work. It could mean providing vocational training, looking to get people into jobs and careers when they're reentering society, helping them find housing, et cetera, changing thinking, a wide range of things. And the research in that is very mixed, but the short answer is there's a huge body of literature saying certain interventions work really well. They work really well sometimes for some people, but not for others, but we know what works. It's called evidence-based practices, and I have some links to resources on that in the handout. But the rest of that story is we don't do it enough. We don't consistently do evidence-based practices in our prison system, in our probation and parole, in our jails, even though we know it works, and I'll kind of talk about why that is. And then there's this idea of just punishment, retribution, accountability. Some people say, I don't care if it does deter them, I just want them to suffer a punishment, which is sometimes hard to understand if it's not going to have any kind of benefit to society. But on the other hand, I recognize that is human nature, that somebody does something really horrific to us or to a loved one, you know, murder, sexual assault, these things that have these, you know, horrible, enduring consequences in people's lives. And some people say, I believe as a society, we should step up and hold those people accountable and punish for the sake of punishment, whether or not it changes them. So that's one of the perspectives on our systems. Then there's this idea of restorative justice, which is actually a really old idea, and it originates from like tribal communities. Kind of start to enjoy a resurgence in the 90s. It's complicated, it's its own lecture, but it's basically the idea of they give back to society and they kind of try to fix the differences, sometimes through reconciliation dialogues, through certain contributions they make to the community. They did prison that I used to work, which is Missouri Eastern Correctional Center. I also worked at the one up in Moberly. Missouri Eastern Correctional Center did continues to do a program in which the offenders make quilts for children at it's either Glennon or Children's Hospital. And so they don't quilt. If you're a quilter, I know that's like a really complex skill. That they don't quilt, but they sew together pieces and they make these quilts. And I always enjoy this image of these, you know, these big tough tattooed bikers sitting around, you know, talking and quilting. But they make these and they're very proud of them and they display them. They do reading for the readings for the blind. They do books on tape. That's a very common industry in prisons. Often as part of their sentence, they're required to pay a certain amount of money into the Restorative Justice Fund that in our state is, I believe it's through our Attorney General's office, but every state has some sort of fund that victims can tap into. And sometimes there's these things for lesser level crimes at the community level where, say, kids vandalize the community. They're invited to come into a setting in which the community members meet with them and say, "We want you to fix this. We want you to go clean up that, and we want you to talk about, you know, the consequences." So, the short of justice movement is a big umbrella, but it's, you know, arguably one of the purposes. And then there's this thing. I think this is kind of what our system really does the best at. It's just to incapacitate them. Our system is pretty good at just keeping people contained during the time they're supposed to be contained. Prison escapes are quite rare. When they do escape, it's quite rare that they commit other crimes. So they've kind of got that part down. Not as successful in probation and parole, but by and large, usually they're able to contain people within the limits of whatever they're using. You know, if it's house arrest with an ankle bracelet, that can work effectively. If it's restrictions from, you know, moving about, you know, because of a lesser level offender and they just can't leave the state. Usually those things are fairly successful. So that's, you know, probably what we do the best is just kind of containing people, but it doesn't have long-term impacts we'd like. What are the big challenges? Well, even though we know all this stuff about evidence-based practice and what works, not all offenders are the same. One of the challenges is that evidence-based practice says you have to really match services and programs and whatever else you're going to offer the offenders to their particular risk and needs. And there are some standardized risk and needs assessments that have been extensively researched that can kind of tell you this kind of profile, this person needs this set of services. We actually know that certain services have the opposite of the intended effect, and they can increase recidivism. So the evidence-based literature says we should really just target moderate to high-risk offenders and low-risk offenders, not provide, you know, provide the minimal level of invasiveness and intervention, because that can actually, for a variety of reasons, lead into higher levels of offending. But that's part of the challenge, is figuring out what's the best appropriate set of strategies and services for anyone. Some people do experience a deterrent effect. Some people go to prison or they're on a period of supervision. They think, I never want to have that happen again, and it has that effect. Some people are changed by incarceration. Nearly everybody I met in prison, everybody I met in prison did not want to come back. I worked with hundreds of offenders, probably a couple thousand over the course of my career. And this idea that, well, if our prisons are too soft, they're going to want to go, they're not going to care if they go back. The punishment has taken away their freedom, and it's a hugely significant punishment, and it makes an impression in their lives. So even though people do adapt, they adapt surprisingly well sometimes to prison, they don't want to come back. So there's at least that temporary deterrent effect. They are getting out with the determination not to come back. Sometimes it just means they don't want to get caught. But for some people, it means they really do try to change. But a lot of times, the realities of their community situation kicks in, and they start going down the same path again. And there are those people who it really has no effect. They're simply planning to not get caught again. Some people do respond very well to rehabilitation. Some not. So this kind of gets into how we get ideas from popular media. You guys recognize that movie, I assume. Okay, Shawshank Redemption. Realistic movie, you think? No? Okay, good movie. This movie, if you've ever read the book, it's a novella by Stephen King called Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption. And the book is, I think, more realistic in terms of Red. You know, Morgan Freeman's always got to be the good guy. Red is a little, he's clearly a sociopath, but he comes across as a little cagier, for lack of a better word. This one is one of these movies where pretty much the prison officials are portrayed as dolts or corrupt. Pretty much if you watch it, they're either stupid or they're like the warden corrupt, and they're part of this, you know, giant corruption conspiracy. And the inmates are by and large kind of good people, with the exception of like the sisters who engage in violent acts and things, but they're kind of portrayed as kind of this good versus bad thing in the reverse way you'd expect. I'm very protective of corrections. I think corrections gets the brunt of the blame for our crime problem. People think we let them out too early, we're too soft. And letting out people out too early is not necessarily something that is caused by corrections. Corrections officials get what's sent to them by the rest of the system. And they have to deal with offenders with the constraints of the sentence to which they're assigned. If they believe somebody's ready to go out and they're serving life without parole or a minimum of 10, they can't put them out there, even though they may have see this as the best time to send them back into society. If they believe somebody shouldn't go out, but they've reached the end of their legal time, which they can find them, they can't do much. So I tend to be protective of movies and TV shows that depict prison officials as all corrupt or not. There's bad people in every profession. By and large, there's a lot of hardworking, well-meaning people that are working in a really tough job. There's this idea we all know, and I think it's characterized best by the character Brooksy in Shawshank, the guy that eventually gets out and suicides because he can't cope at all. And now you think about people getting out today's society who went to prison in like the late 90s, cell phones are just like blowing these people's minds. I've talked to offenders I interview in my research, and they're like, my God, these things, you know. It's like a sci-fi novel. Of course, they knew about it. You're exposed to television. You see your family. You know what's going on. But really getting at it now, being in this society in which, you know, technology is driving so much of our lives, is a huge shakeup. And, you know, the job market has been significantly changed as a result of that. So people adapt, which is kind of a good thing. We kind of look for prisonization to happen because it keeps the prison more manageable. But, of course, the downside is it's an artificial environment in which they're living, and it's not conducive to getting back out and living in the world if you adapted successfully in prison. Movies like Escape from Alcatraz, which is a true case, it's actually one of the more realistic movies I've seen. in terms of how, it's pretty much based on the actual story. A lot of people are surprised at the amount. Anybody seen this movie? A lot of people are surprised at the amount of freedom these guys have at Alcatraz, The Rock. You know, that's the toughest prison in America at the time. It was a federal prison, and people like Al Capone served their sentence there. But they did have the kind of freedoms you see where he's, you know, working in the barber shop and sweeps up the hair to put on the makeshift dummies. That photo is actually mine. It was taken when I toured. Does anybody ever toured Alcatraz? Really, really cool and fun. And one of the reasons they could allow those types of privileges, again, is because, well, the idea, I mean, I've talked about that, but privileges play an important role in managing prisons. It's not just being soft, and I'll talk some more about that. But they were on this isolated environment, this island, you know, where nobody ever escaped except these three guys that they never found again. They probably didn't successfully escape. But yeah, it really showed life on the island, which was just living in this community. One of the weirdest things I thought when I went to Alcatraz was the high school there. Have you remember that? So a lot of the correctional officers and other workers lived on the island for weeks at a time, and then they would ferry back to the mainland when their, you know, 2 weeks stint or whatever was over. And so there's an old, it's falling down, but it's the building that would serve as the high school when their families would come out for those 2 weeks. And I can imagine having your senior prom in Alcatraz. This movie, everybody probably recognizes, is Green Mile. And that one, of course, the magical mystical element's not realistic. But what I think is realistic here is the relationship you see between the officers on death row and the character, I can't remember his name. Maybe we saw that is that when I asked people what's realistic, like, well, yeah, the way the officers were kind of like bonded with them and things. Well, I did my dissertation on, it was called The Big House in a Small Town, and it was the economic and social impacts of a correctional facility in a host community. We historically have built our prisons in rural, isolated communities, and they become the industry for those communities in the same way that the Chevy plant or, you know, the mines are the industry. And the people that come to work there don't have degrees in criminal justice, haven't been working in the profession, in law enforcement, in any other capacity for the most part. They're the people who need a job, just like they would go to the mine or to the auto plant. And they don't have training in how to properly engage and interact with offenders. They're trained on keeping professional distance, but that's easier said than done. And the people that we get to know, that we share our problems with, and that we commiserate with, are the people we spend our days with. Officers who work in a very isolated, where there's just a couple of them in a cell block, tend to get to know the offenders. It's not considered a good thing. They're supposed to keep some professional boundaries. But I've seen this type of relationship form where they have a lot in common. Sometimes they even know them from the community. The Tosi Correctional Center, where we used to do our executions down in southeast Missouri, at one time the warden from there lived next door to a man that he had to execute. Our wardens actually pushed the button on the lethal injection apparatus. And an inmate that was getting executed there was his father was his neighbor. Now, this was in a rural community, so neighbor could mean like half a mile away. But nonetheless, you know, rural neighbors. So they had these kind of odd, kind of strained relationships sometimes with the people in their communities. Some families will come and settle in communities to be near their loved ones if they're doing a long sentence. So you might go to the, you know, the hairstylist salon, and she's the wife of the guy that's, you know, in your cell block. So these, you know, there isn't the kind of optimal with law enforcement, for instance, and the courts. There is a lot of it's easier to keep those professional boundaries, but there can be a lot of blurring of those in prisons. And then again, the idea of the really stupid and corrupt people, fortunately, is not the norm. But that's a lot of what people take away. They don't really take away a sense of what are good people doing in prisons. You know, what is it? What are their worlds and jobs like? We also see this, every movie that involves somebody going to prison, in which that's the centerpiece of the story, has the dramatic, you know, visit where they put the hand up and sometimes kiss through the window and things. Fortunately, most visits don't look like that at all. Jails sometimes do, and in fact, the orange jumpsuits are much more common in jails. They're not the standard uniform in prisons. But in jails sometimes, because remember, people are pre-sentenced, and their level of risk is uncertain. So on one hand, they're innocent and proven guilty, but their level of risk may be uncertain, and so it necessitates doing visits in a more kind of restricted setting. Jails tend to be smaller facilities, and they don't have the layout always like this. This would be a typical visiting room, this kind of room, this size. But the other people that would be in prison are people who are in some kind of segregation status. The vast majority of our prisoners are out and about moving for the majority of the day. only a very small percentage of offenders are in 23/7 lockdown. And then they always get that 1 hour to, you know, bathe and to do a little bit of rec. But that kind of segregation is quite rare. It's for disciplinary reasons. Sometimes it is long-term when you end up in a full lockdown facility or a full lockdown cell block unit because of persistent or very serious offenses. When I ask my students, who do you think is on the 23/7, they always say, well, the murderers, the rapists, the gang leaders. No, it has nothing to do with your crime. It has to do with your behavior while you're in prison. So most visiting looks just like this, where they have open kind of settings. And there's cameras around. There's restrictions like you can't touch across the table and certain things. But they do allow people to, you know, hold their children and to hug their loved ones and things. They can be, you know, depending on the officer that's enforcing them. I've seen officers that are like, you know, 5 second hug and you're done. Others are a little more understanding, but they're still able to monitor for safety because we do know that a lot of drugs and contraband comes in from visitors. But it's not the number one. What do you think is the number one way drugs and contraband come into prisons?
The
kitchen. Well, but oh, so it comes in through. Okay, so delay. Yeah, it's staff, and it could be outside people who are out, who are contractors and doing outside deliveries. But it's through staff, which again is that blurring of boundaries. It's not necessarily bad people, but it's kind of like, you know, hey, could you get this letter to my wife? And they do that, and then they say, would you mind? Just let me use your phone for a minute and call my wife. And then the third or fourth time they come back, I'm like, could you get me in some drugs here? And the officer says, well, no. And they're like, really? Because I got evidence that you've been helping me with this other stuff. They do a whole training called Anatomy of a Setup in the Corrections Academies about how to figure out, you know, how to, you don't even make that little step. But and the offenders themselves can be quite creative. There was a raccoon, it was a possum, was found when I was, it was after I worked there, but I was on one of the tours. Somebody had thrown a possum over the fence that had been opened, cleaned out, put some drums in, tossed it over the fence. And it was noticed by the tower officers that these guys kind of kept walking around the possum and looking around, like, we got to check out this possum. So visits are one place it gets in, but we also recognize that visits are, short of release, visits are the most powerful incentive for good behavior. People want to behave so they can see their loved ones, so they can have that distraction, so they can sometimes have food brought in. A lot of places love food business, and this kind of opportunity to just kind of feel like you're you know, not in prison. And then religion is actually quite a big thing. This is a visit of the Pope coming into the prison somewhere. Religion, I'm not really sure always. There's no hard data on do people who become religious in prison reoffend again. I don't think we would see any kind of real distinct correlation. For some people, it's clearly just a thing to say to the parole board, hey, look, I've been going to service all the time or involved with this group. For others, it is something they have some commitment to, but it, for whatever reason, doesn't connect to any kind of change in their behavior. And some people do connect in a way that it's kind of, I need to be a better person thing. So religious privileges are quite extensive in prison. It's something that generally they want to allow, encourage people. Missouri recognizes something like, this always blows my mind, it's like 21 religions, of which only one is Christianity. So when I say 21, it's not like Baptist, Protestant, Methodist, Christianity and all that, and then all these others. So they're hoping to encourage, if nothing else, just you're spending your time doing something other than getting in trouble. How common is violence in prison? Well, in the movies, we know it's quite common. People are, and that's the, you know, plot. It makes for a more interesting movie when we see that happening. Surprisingly, I think, I don't know, many people's right, intra-racial are more common than interracial, which is not to say that there's not racial tension in prisons. Racial tension is huge. The offenders I work with are some of the most racist people I know. The whites don't like the blacks don't like the whites. And this is, you know, part of their culture in which they were raised. They're very distrustful. Most people will, as they call it, cell, they'll share a cell with somebody of the same race. It wasn't until the early 2000s when the Supreme Court, I'm not sure it was a higher court, I'm not sure it was a Supreme Court, but there was a court law, case law that said you can't automatically put the whites with the whites and the blacks with the blacks. When I worked there up into the mid-90s, that was standard. Unless you said, I got a black buddy, I'm willing, you know, I'm white, I got a black buddy, and you would actually sign a waiver saying you would do that. One state, and I can remember, it's either Alabama or Arkansas, it's Alabama, still does that, despite case law saying they're not supposed to. But even when Missouri said, well, okay, we'll do it the other way, offenders have some discretion in saying that they want to sell with somebody else. And if you can't find any, you know, illicit activity connecting them, a lot of times you're willing to do that because it results in just, you know, less tension. So even if a white ends up with a black offender, a lot of times they'll go and they'll say, no, I don't want to be with this person. So the reason we have more interracial assaults is because the assaults tend to be about the things they are in the community. Differences between people, arguments, fights over a card game. They're not supposed to gamble in prison, but they often do, and they do play cards and dominoes and dice games. So fights over that. Somebody insulted somebody. Somebody insulted somebody's girlfriend. There's some drug money owed or something. So those are more common than there are. When interracial ones happen, they tend to have some underlying kind of organized activity, like gang conflict involved. Inmate on inmate assaults typically more common than inmate on staff assaults. Although six states reported higher rates, this is some data from the early 2000s that looked kind of deconstructed the data and looked at it more closely. I haven't seen any more recent. My belief about this is these states are defining it differently. Inmate on staff assaults are always known, are always documented. Inmate on inmate assaults, how you document and identify and count those varies by state. So if you suspect it because somebody shows up with a black eye, you might document that as an inmate-on-inmate assault unless you saw them, you know, fall or something. And other states may only document things in which the person admits I was beat up, but because of the no-snitch policy, a lot of them won't admit. So inmate-on-inmate, I think even in these six sites, truly are the more common thing. What about sexual assault? Again, a common theme in movies. We see it in with Andy's character in Shawshank Redemption. And it almost seems to just be the norm in any kind of movie primarily set in a prison setting. Fortunately, the reality is it's not as common as popular media would have us believe. An estimated 4%, 2.2% of jails reported experiencing one or more incidents by another inmate or facility staff. And in Missouri and many states, staff sex with inmates, even if they're consenting, is still a felony. So those do get reported as assaults because it's seen as abuse of authority or power. Even if they were truly consulting, it's going to be prosecuted as such. And we see at the high end, some data shows as many as 20%. And again, this has to do with how it's defined. So that 4 to 3 to 2 is based on some hard knowledge of they know it happened, the inmate admitted to it, or perhaps they were even caught in the act, or another inmate agreed to provide witness testimony that they saw it, which is rare. The rest of the data comes from things like surveys in which they go around, they ask offenders, how many of you have been personally sexually assaulted? And even those numbers still tend to be pretty low, with less than 5% saying personally. But then they ask the inmates, how often do you think it happens? And then we start to see creeping up to like higher than 10%. And when they ask staff, how often do you think it happens? They're sometimes saying as much as 20% of the time. So the staff estimates are the highest, but the truth probably seems a lot in the middle because the people who are most in a position to know, the offenders themselves, give lower ratings. Nonetheless, it's a serious problem even at 4%. PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, which was passed under George W. Bush, has given a lot of funding to jails, mostly to do things like put cameras in areas that are prone to assaults and rapes where there's lack of visibility, and to take other measures to encourage open reporting, to train staff on warning signs and things. It's difficult to measure because we don't know the true amount happening, but probably has resulted in a reduction of a couple percent. So it's had something positive. And then the people who are more likely to be victimized, we see those people with serious psychological distress are more likely to be exploited and victimized. And not just for sexual victimization, but you know they're more likely to be fleeced for convincing them to have their mom send money into them to another offender or to take their goods. They have commissaries, canteens at prisons where they can shop for all manner of things, snacks and razors and little, they still have, most prisons have the old Walkman, you know, style things. So they purchase this stuff and other inmates may pressure them to, you know, give me ramen noodles and things. And again, it tends to be younger offenders. It tends to be people, not surprisingly, who are less criminally sophisticated and don't have a lot of relationships with the other offenders to kind of support them, and people who have psychological issues. So this is just some of the stats, how frequently, this is a little more expanding on it, the likelihood of experiencing sexual assaults in prisons and jails is really not higher than the likelihood of experiencing it in our community, which, you know, really shouldn't be reassuring. It should be kind of terrifying, you know. But it suffice to say that the media depictions of it are often overstated, that everybody's going to get assaulted, everybody's going to get shanked when they come in. Suicide, homicide rates, this is, again, older data, but I couldn't find, I looked at the later numbers are about the same as what we're seeing here at the end. I just couldn't find a graph that took it all the way out to here. I didn't have time to put all that data in a spreadsheet and turn it into a graph. So these are the trends. This is interesting. So suicide, why do you think it's higher in jails than prisons? Because jails, you're probably not going to be there long. It has to do with the uncertainty and the fact that the jail is your first stop after you've been arrested. And so the reality of what has happened has sunk in. The most high-risk people for jails are people with very limited criminal history, usually young white males from suburban communities or from stable families. So people for whom this is a real anomaly in their lives. And what's happened to bring that down is a lot of changes in terms of training staff better on risk identification and more cameras and more routine observation of people who are believed to be at risk. And then prisons, you know, I used to have to respond to a lot of suicide watches in our prison. The people who most often reported somebody was considering suicide were the other offenders, usually their cellmates. They would come to me or one of the other psychologists or to the correctional officers and say, my cellie's been giving all his stuff away, and he's saying, I'm going to miss you, buddy, or, you know, something. They picked up on that. I think we should really even do more training with the offenders to help make them aware. Some are just, we're good at picking it up. And so we were able to intervene in these people's, you know, situations and things. And then homicide, not surprisingly, is more common in prisons. Just there's more opportunity for people to build relationships that then go wrong. So jails, it's pretty much not necessarily been a significant problem. People ask about conjugal visits because you see that in movies. Four states actually allow them: California, Connecticut, New York, and Virginia. And they're very specific in how they work. It's not like you can, like, call up a prostitute to come up for your conjugal or something. I think they all require that you're married or at least had common law marriage established before you came to prison. And it's intended, this is some of the very old common law cottages at Angola Prison. This is a more modern setup. It's usually in a trailer on the premises. It's intended as a segue to reentry. So it's for offenders who are approaching reentering the community, for the most part, and they get this privilege of a weekend where you're going to have your wife and your children, if you have some, come up to this trailer and kind of try to practice living a normal life. And you have to have a really spotless record for, you know, varies, but probably at least 12 months or something before you can get this. And again, it's for people who are moving towards going to the community. The research is not real strong. It's pretty mixed, showing whether what some people think is if we let them have conjugal visits, then there'd be less sexual assaults. The research, most evidence shows that's not happening because it's not, sexual assaults in prison in the community is not about sex. It's about power. It's not that they're sex starved and rape one another. It's a display of power and aggression. But the reason it may have some effect is because, in general, it increases good behavior across the board if a lot of people who are approaching release have that incentive for them. I don't think Missouri has ever locked them, that I recall. How are males versus females different? Nearly half of male inmates versus a smaller percentage of females looking for violent offenses, so may pose a greater risk within the prison, maybe serving longer sentences. Women seem to respond better to prison programs, as even as I said earlier, the program's not necessarily tailored to them. I'm not really sure what women's prison industries and job training is like now, and I keep meaning to ask my colleagues inside that. But when I was there, it tended to be very sexist type of stuff. The women were trained to like to sew, a lot of beautician, cosmetologist types of programs for women, whereas men were getting things that would lead to higher paying jobs, like they were working in industries, maybe building furniture. They do make license plates in prison, but, you know, learning kind of factory skill jobs or auto mechanics or something that could lead to probably a better paying job. One of the things that we did have a recent conversation, they still do the cosmetology programs. I had a conversation recently with the groups I'm working with on reentry about some of the restrictions people face coming out in the community because of their offenses. And there is a group that's working to put legislation through to do things like ban the box, and to look at some of these restrictions more closely. One of the guys who works on our reentry is an ex-offender. He formerly did time in jail, appeared in probation. He has a master's degree. He's very professional. He's very polished. He works in the nonprofit world now. He tells me he could never work at a 7-Eleven or a gas station in Missouri or any state that has a lottery because he can't sell lottery tickets, which is a pretty, you know, I get it, but it's a pretty useless sort of restriction because that's an entry-level job for a lot of people they could use. With women, a lot of women are on the child abuse registry, which is a different thing than the sexual abuse registry, but it is permanent. And if you have a charge of abuse and neglect, which many women do just as a nature part of their offense, they're arrested for, they live with a meth cook and they're arrested for the meth and the children get taken, they wind up on this registry permanently. One of the restrictions is you can't get certain types of licenses, including like cosmetologists and hairstylist licenses. Yet our state system is still training people on this set of skills. So either we need to re-examine, do we really need to take away their licenses to be cosmetologists? And if so, then let's not train them on the skill while they're in there. And with women's prisons, we don't have the same kind of security levels. Most states have like 5 security levels, with 5 being the highest level of security. Women's, because you just don't have that same kind of concern about violence within the prisons, they tend to be just a few levels within in the system. And I see women don't really seem to do the race segregation that we see in the prisons in terms of socialization and who they will share a cell with. They tend to have more of a kind of across-the-board kind of sisterhood thing going on. Security threat groups, which we call, sorry, I'm checking the time, okay. Gangs, also shown as very predominant in, you know, if you watch Prison Break or any of the TV shows. Again, depends on how you count, you know, security threat group members, gang members in your prison. At the low end, we see about 7 to 13%. At any given time. Again, this is older data. There's not necessarily newer data that gets into the nitty-gritty like some of this data did. But some states, Wisconsin said they had as many as 43% of their people in gangs, and a couple states said no, like 1%. So most of that, California has actually a lot of gangs that originated there, so we would expect that 1% is underrepresented. But it depends on, some states may say you have to, you know, have the gang tattoo, you have to be overtly caught in some gang activity, or we don't consider you a security threat group member. Other institutions say if you have past affiliation or if you even are observed socializing, we document that because you were socializing with the Aryans or the Crips, and so that's where we see the higher levels. But the gangs, despite even when they are a lower percentage of the population, they're responsible for a disproportionate amount of the problems. The contraband coming in, the drugs, the violence, and so forth. They control all the bad stuff, you know. What do people really do? Well, some people, that very small percentage, really do just sit in their cells all day. But the rest of them are doing things. They're out working and in the vocational training to learn how to be a cosmetologist or how to fix a car or making a license plate or working in a factory. They have certain jobs where they actually called these jobs pushers when I worked in the prison, which, you know, kind of the drug pusher kind of irony. They were the guys who would push others around in the wheelchairs. Because we had the handicapped offenders. So somebody's job would be assigned to take care of a handicapped person. They would sell with them. Barbers. When I got married, I didn't have time to go to my hairstylist, so I went to the free prison barber. Because he always cut my hair for free, and he was so excited. He got really nervous. I'm like, just do what you normally do. You know? But they're doing a lot of things that keep them busy there, allow them to earn a little bit of money. I think the top pay probably in the nation is no more than $50 a month, and sometimes it's as little as $7 a month. We can't compel people to work, but we can incentivize it to the part where nearly everybody has some job. And some of those are not, they're not quite 40 hours a week, but they're like 32 hours a week that they're in the factories and places doing things. We have Shakespeare in prison. We have all sorts of sports in prisons. Tom, I was talking before, said he went in as a young man and played on a team with people in prisons. They don't do that in Missouri. I don't know if other states do, but they would invite teams from the community. Shakespeare, I put on there the prison performing arts links on this handout I have back there. If you're interested in going to see the prison plays, they're fantastic. I think Bowling Green does them. Missouri Eastern out in Pacific does them still. They do Shakespeare. They put on improv plays. I've taken my students. It's really cool. And they show movies within the prison. They have bands. We put on little concerts within the prison. And then they do those, you know, make the quilts and write, you know, tapes for the blind and other restorative justice. So some people say, and that's just more, and then they hang out, they I loved work in prison. I miss it because it was actually, people were like, isn't it really bleak and depressing? I'm like, no, it's like a really vibrant, colorful environment. And, oh my God, today I know they're arguing about the election coming up this week. They're fighting about politics. They were probably fighting about the World Series or, you know, the football games, you know, the zoo game yesterday. They're interested in the world. They pay attention to it. And they're not just sitting around plotting their next crimes or how to break out. They're quite engaged in what's happening in the rest of the world. Why do we have all these privileges? Part of it is economics, meaning it offsets the cost of jobs in the prison. So sometimes when a community bids hard to get the prison to come to their rural community to be the industry, they're disappointed to find that a lot of jobs are filled by prisoners. Okay? So food service, for instance, will have what Missouri, there's different slang and jargon in different prisons. Missouri always called them the square staff, which was the civilians. So there's square staff supervisors, but most of the food service is done by the inmates themselves. They are the custodians. I had the inmates that would work for me. They would tutor people in the therapy that couldn't read the therapy materials. These guys would either tutor or make audio tapes for them. I would hire them, you know, other offenders, and they would clean my office and make my coffee, and just kind of, they would, this was back with typewriters, they would type up memos when my secretary was busy and things. So they're doing the kind of jobs that we might be hiring people for, custodial maintenance and things. So that's one of the reasons. It does save taxpayers money, but of course it has the downside of fewer people from the community being hired. The idea of giving them a stake in conformity. I was telling Tom before, there was a story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch a couple years ago about a guy who got involved in the Shakespeare program in prison. We don't have hard data on whether that really rehabilitates and changes people. The numbers of people participating are just too small. But in this guy's case, the anecdotal evidence showed that this was the thing that kept him out. He got out and he got a steady job, not a great paying job somewhere. He was a long-term, you know, had served probably like 18 years, had the last sentence had been in and out before that. And he said that he was working for, I think it was Kirkwood Community Theater, and he was very engaged. He was in all the plays. If he wasn't in the play, he was building the scenery, blah, blah. And he said, this is what's keeping me out. I never want to go back because we can do so much, the plays are so much better here than we can do in there. And that became this idea of this stake in conformity. And criminologists note that that's one of the things sometimes that differentiates the non-recidivist from the recidivist, whether it's their wife or the job or prison theater, something they become attached to that means I want to be out here with the rest of you. I don't want to do those things that sent me to somewhere where I'm going to lose these things. We need balance in prison. We can't simply punish. Evidence-based practice shows us that we work better with people when we do contingency-based management. So rather than saying you lose points or get kind of demerits in prison and now you can't go to the movie or you can't go out and play baseball on the field, it's better to reward people for the, you know, for good behavior. So reward them for a while, you want a week without any violations, and therefore you're going to earn this privilege. So it works for good management, helps reduce mental stress, and therefore lower evidence of mental illness than if we simply confine people to cells all day. Plus, the Constitution says that we have to allow certain opportunities for people in regard, particularly to religion. Free speech may have to do with things like people have sued about whether they can write to people in the community when wardens have tried to take away that privilege. Courts have been somewhat mixed on that. They have said you don't have a right to write letters to other prisoners. But in terms of getting in books and publications, they've been surprisingly open in some other ways where people want to bring in materials from the outside. So case law precedent is going to guide what some prisons are going to be expected to do. And so we hear about prisoners suing people. They do. I've been sued multiple times. Not because of anything directly I did, but because of the program I represented. It was seen as, in the program I worked in, if you didn't complete the sex offender treatment program and you had a sexual assault, you could not get parole. So I was frequently sued, particularly when I was director. I was once sued, but it was actually a grievance a guy filed because he said my skirt, he saw me walking across the yard and I had on a sundress, light colored dress, and he could see the slipped in gold went out. So he saw this part of my you know, my calf. And he sued saying, this is just provocative. I didn't sue Federer. This is just provocative. Miss T's walking around out there, and we can see her calf through the dress because her slip didn't go down long enough. Needless to say, they just dismissed that and said, we have a dress code. We follow it. You know, not in your business. People sued for not having salad bars in Missouri for a lot of things that really were petty. On the other hand, starting in the 1960s, inmates' lawsuits had a very dramatic effect on changing conditions for the better. You know, stopping a lot of the practices like you see in Shawshank and things where they kind of operated in isolation, because until 1964, when a guy named Cooper sued in Indiana, the court's position was inmates had no right to sue. And the statute that they defended that with was actually a statute about slavery. That was just, you're prisoners of the state, you're basically the same as slaves, and we don't need to pay attention to you. So it was actually a good thing. It kind of opened the floodgates for a lot of important lawsuits. You know, unfortunately, it becomes the bane of existence for people in prisons when you're repeatedly responding to grievances and things that aren't meaningful. But I think we need to keep that door open. We need to be able to give them a voice to the community. I had something on evidence-based practice, but yeah. So this idea of, you know, why is it that we don't do all these things that we know work? Why don't we have better programs and interventions? Why don't we give them the meaningful services and across the board, which we could do, apply those services and interventions in a way that makes sense to each type of offender, matching them to what they need, giving them those things, and not just simply doing what we've always done, doing these programs that increase recidivism, or simply warehousing and punishing people. Why don't we do it? One of them runs this idea that's called the death of expertise. There's a guy named Tom Nichols from Yale, from Stanford, wrote a fantastic book about this, and about how, in part because of the internet and 24/7 news, where we just go into our echo chamber and we talk to people and we read what reinforces existing beliefs, many people are still stuck on the idea that crime is worse than ever. When I do a lot of community presentations, like, how many of you think crime has gone up in the last 20 years? Most people raise their hand, even though it's completely false. And most people tend to believe, I think if we just made those prisons tough enough, many people tend to believe, if we made those prisons tough enough, we wouldn't do it again. We need to take away the privileges. Rehabilitation doesn't work. People believe they're experts when they're not, and they only look for ideas that reinforce them. And when you know, what can you do with this knowledge? I tell people that are interested, you be ambassadors. You ask them, well, how do you know that? Why do you think that? And share with them what you know and say, actually, this is a reality. Certain things do work very well. They're going to be getting out anyway. Maybe we need to figure out a better way to manage this problem. I love this idea of evidence-based practices just taking root everywhere. A few states have. Washington is one. Ohio have actually implemented either legislation or department policy saying, within the next year, everything needs to be an evidence-based practice in the prisons and in probation and parole. And then in 3 years, or 25% needs to be. In 3 years, half of what we do needs to be. In 5 years, all of it. And you know what? They're seeing that there's not a lot of new costs attached to this. It's merely shifting away from the stuff that doesn't work. And then they're seeing the costs on the back end when they have the reduced recidivism people return. And people also, again, popular culture. People watch these shows and they see prisoners in this very one-dimensional way, and they believe that's what prisons are like or should be like, or these are all uniformly bad people that can't be helped. So my idea is, I think we need like a new TV show. We get some hot mamas and we call it the evidence-based practice files, making it work. And it could be guys too. I just found that picture and you see kind of like tough looking ladies, they didn't have guns or anything. You know, we need to saturate our media with the right information. We need to pay attention to what we know is good. We should expect more from our government. We should demand more from our government. And we should be the informed voices that let them know we want to get it right, and we want to get out of this ditch we're in, where we persist in doing the wrong things and spinning our wheels. As I said, I did put some handouts back here. If you're into, think prison culture is fascinating, take a day trip. Anybody toured the Jeff City Correctional Center? Isn't it fabulous? I'm a prison geek. You can spend the night there, too.
It's eye-opening.
It's eye-opening, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's some fascinating trivia about it. James Earl Ray was on escape status from that prison when he assassinated Dr. King. When I worked there, I looked him up in our archives one time and found he was still listed as escaped, even though by that time he was doing time down in Tennessee. The boxer Sonny Liston, who went on to fight Muhammad Ali later. He honed his skills when he came to prison. He became a boxer there. And they tell you all this history. Emma Goldman, the was the fought for the Reds, the communists in early 19-teens Russia. She did time there. Really fascinating place. And you can do a ghost tour. You can spend the night in a cell. They've really turned this into a kind of kitschy tourist attraction. But important piece of history. So there's information for that link on that handout. And then there's some other information about some of the unique YouTube or video about a hospice in the Angola State Penitentiary with the inmates caring for one another, Puppies for Parole, where the inmates learn basic dog care at our prisons here, and then they put those puppies out for adoption, and some other innovative things that are going on. And I gave you some links to some of the places where you can find out more about this evidence-based stuff. So thank you for your time. Hope you learned something.